My name is Bob Darrell. I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Dick and the members of the committee for the privilege of attending this conference and participating, which is, sometimes I wonder why people ask me. In my head, I don't know. I'm going to leave that alone. My sponsor's sitting halfway back in the room. In case I embarrass him, he won't have to take credit for me. Polly, you got to do something with Dave. I'm telling you, you got work to do. Oh, he's out of control. There's a lot of people here I really love and care about. When Dave was talking about implying that speakers have a tendency to be long-winded, I'm tasked to speak on the first three steps, which I understand this could be done in its simplicity, probably in about 5 or 10 minutes. But that's not going to stop me from using an hour. I had a sponsee one time who went to the end of the month intergroup speaker meeting, and there was a local speaker who was known for being a little long-winded, who got to the podium and said, introduced himself and said, I don't know where to begin, and Richard yelled out, as close to the end as possible. which was pretty funny. My name is Bob Darrell. I am alcoholic. I've been sober through Alcoholics Anonymous since October 31st, 1978. That is the big miracle in my life. I'm going to try to talk about my experience and my difficulties with these steps, because I always like to hear people's what they do. I get more out of what you did wrong than I did about what you did right. And I had a hard time with step one. And I think, as working with a lot of guys over the years, I think it's the most difficult thing we do. I think it's so difficult with our mindset, it kills most of us. This absolute inability, as the book says, to fully concede to my innermost self that I'm alcoholic. I admitted in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in different institutions for years that I was an alcoholic. I could admit that, but I'll admit just about anything if people are looking at me. And I could admit that, but that doesn't mean that I really believed it inside me. And I was placating because I didn't want a problem. I didn't want five of you to come up to me after the meeting. And, I would admit that I was an alcoholic. But I really didn't believe it. And to be honest, I don't even think I understood what it was to be an alcoholic. What I was really admitting is that I got some problems. I'm in this institution. But alcoholic, I don't even know what that means. And I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I had a couple uncles that were alcoholics, and everybody in the family knew they were pathetic, and I'm not going to be like that. Before I could admit that I was an alcoholic, I could admit that I was a drug addict. There was a little panache in that. There were rock stars that were drug addicts. I could admit that. I could admit that I was a mental health case, because you get pills in that territory, and I'm in for that, But I'm not an alcoholic. There was no one I looked up to that peed their pants. And yet I did that frequently. So I had a hard time. And then what happened to me through the school of hard knocks, I suppose, and trying to control and enjoy my drinking and failing, and trying to control and enjoy it and failing year after year, coupled with a continued exposure to your experience in Alcoholics Anonymous and different treatment centers, I eventually became intellectually bludgeoned into an acceptance that I got that thing that you talk about. That I take the first drink, and it, no matter what my intentions are, it sets something off that I don't know where it's going to go. And I got it, and here's the kind of mindset I have. I don't know how ego dominant I am, but I got the kind of ego that fancies that knowledge is power. So I think that now that I know, and I really know that I can't take the first drink, coupled by a sincere desire not to, you know, I got to turn my life around. I'm a mess, for God's sakes. I get that. And I thought I was out of the woods, and actually I was entering into the most horrific years of my life. The years of swearing to myself time and time again, man, I'm not going to touch that stuff again. And I'd always eventually go back to it. I didn't understand that. I knew that I had an abnormal reaction to alcohol, and that's what makes me an alcoholic. But I didn't understand that I had an abnormal reaction to abstinence, and that's what makes me chronic. And I didn't understand that, because some of the stuff that happens to me when I get sober is not huge emotional displacements. It's smaller, more gnawing stuff inside of me. And the stuff that just works on me day in and day out and week out, until I eventually get to a point where I can't think of anything except the possibility of relief. And then I go. And I the only relief I've ever known in my life that was instantaneous and immediate and effective had been 4 or 5 shots of whiskey. Now, Silkworth says something in the doctor's opinion that really was very true for me. He says, after a time, guys like me can't differentiate the true from the false. So what does that mean? Well, it means that I've entered into the late stages of my alcoholism, a stage where when I drink now, it's pathetic. When I drink, I go into depression and I feel sorry for myself. I feel so pathetically lonely that I call people on the phone at 4 in the morning and cry into the phone. My ex-girlfriends, we should have got married. That kind of, you know, that kind of pathetic. And this is not, I don't bathe anymore. I'm not the guy in the clubs, you know, trying to hit on the girls and shooting pool. I'm not that guy. I'm the pathetic guy now. And I used to be the guy. I used to be the guy that, man, I'd get lit up and I'm the man. I'm not that guy anymore. And yet you put me in a state of abstinence, prolonged abstinence for several months, and I start imagining that I'm that guy again. I start imagining that there's a party where the truth is there is not a party, but you don't know that until you start and become pathetic again and swear to yourself, I'm never doing this again. And I can't see the truth because of this. The book calls it self-delusion. It's like psychotic wishful thinking. It's, I want there to be a party so badly that I ignore reality and I imagine that there's a party where there really is, it's where it's really become pathetic. And so I relapse again and again, and I don't know what's happening to me, and people in treatment centers and in AA say crazy things to me, like, "Well, just think the drink through." You know what that does? I think it through, and I hurry up to get there. You know, it does. My insanity is I'm willing to for 20 minutes of relief. I'm willing to bet my life. I'm willing to risk prison. I'm willing to do, because I drank on paper. I was told by a judge 2 years, and I drank and I took a run at it anyway, because I ain't right sober and I don't know what's going on. I remember being in a halfway house in Pennsylvania, and the guy that ran the place, he wasn't an alcoholic. He was a professional counselor of sorts, and he came to me one day, and I guess I didn't look happy, joyous, and free, I suppose, and I'm half-assed depressed all the time, and I don't feel very good, and he said to me one day, he wanted to help me, he just said, "Bob, what's wrong?" And I remember just staring at him, and I wish I could have told him. I wish I could have found the words to tell him what's wrong, but the truth is, I don't know. It's just that nothing's right. And I'm isolated in me, locked up in me, because I quit drinking, I just get me right on me, and I can't get me off of me, and that's like I just... I smear everything about me across the windshield of my car until I can't see nothing else except me, basically. And that's not this is not new. This is not a new problem induced by drinking. I'd had this. I drank to free myself from that propensity. I look back at my childhood, and the only thing I remember with any clarity is me. I mean, I can't tell you about my mother and father much. I mean, it was unless they had to do with me. I was up here in this control center judging the universe. It was all about me. And I didn't understand any of that. I just knew that after a time, abstinence seemed to be unbearable to me. And I never understood why, what was happening to me, because I didn't understand that. I thought alcoholism had something to do with alcohol. And it does, in the sense that I have the physical allergy. I believe that. I can't stop. But if that was all there was, then that Nancy Reagan just say no thing would work for a guy like me. And I can say no for a while. And that's the insidious thing. Because the longer I say no, the more I puff myself up with a sense of control that doesn't even exist until the day comes and I pick up the first drink again. And I didn't know what was wrong, and people in AA are trying to help me. And they, like, just don't drink. Yeah, I know. Just don't drink no matter what. Yeah, I know. I just can't do it. And I didn't understand that the real problem was a lack of power. I went to a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists. I went through a lot of treatment centers trying to obtain power, I suppose. I didn't think in those terms, but I guess that was really the motivation behind all of it, the power to control my life, the power to be okay, the power to, so I wouldn't feel so pathetically squirmy and alone and depressed when I'm sober. Or I would take the other side of the equation, too, if I could have shifted my drinking back to the way it was when I was 18 years old. I'll take either one of the sides of that equation. Either change me so that I'm okay sober, or let me go back to... And the worst thing about alcoholism is you lose both alternatives in the late stages of it. And that's the fabric of what guys that drives guys like me to suicide. Because Clancy says it best. He says you get to a place where there's no friendly direction. They're not even in the bottle. There's nowhere to go here. That is a hopelessness. I'm in and out of AA, and you guys are... Oh, you talk a lot about God. Which was intellectually offensive to me. I mean, no. I mean, I have a lot of therapy. I mean, this is... And I don't want to... I wanted to be an atheist. I couldn't really pull it off. To be a good atheist, you have to be very religious about your atheism. I can't get enough angst to be a good atheist. What I really and truly am is I'm a guy who's afraid of God. I'm a guy who, to this day, if I just think you don't like me, I'm going to not like you first. And I was that way with God. I'm just too bad at being good and too good at being bad. I can be good for a while and then it's like I outgood myself and I can't. My being good for a while is like putting torque on my bad, that when I finally run out of power, some of the worst, most hideous drunks I've ever been on was after long periods of being good. And then I just go like that. And I couldn't stop that. And people in AA keep talking about God. I was scared of God. I knew about God. I had a lot of religious upbringing when I was a kid. I've been taught by Dominicans and Franciscans, and I had a lot of that. But I don't hear what other people hear. And that is true sometimes today. That's why I have to have a sponsor. That's why I have to have some accountability in my life. Because my mind imagines problems that don't exist. See, no, I don't hear the positive stuff. And this is kind of true. It's pathetically kind of true today. On a bad spiritual hair day, I walk into a meeting. I don't notice how wonderfully the people are there. But I'll start seeing the ones that are potentially a problem. You know, you can tell by their body language that they're thinking stuff that ain't right. You know, and I just look, I'm a noticer. I get this noticer that just kicks on in my head, just notices that kind of stuff. I don't notice the good stuff. I notice that kind of stuff because I'm always defending myself against problems. So I didn't hear about a God of love. I think everybody else probably did. I didn't hear about that. I heard about a God of judgment who existed to judge me, it seemed, from what I was hearing, what was scaring me. And he could see in the dark, that's not good for me. I don't care about the trouble. The fun starts in the dark. You know what I'm saying? And he could read my mind. Isn't that a hideous proposition? I mean, I remember I had this nun, I'm in grade school, I'm a little kid, I'm trying to be good, I am trying. And this nun, she was kind of young, kind of cute, she would have been pretty if she hadn't all the hardware on, I suppose. And she would say this, I bet you she always liked she was saying it at me. She'd say, "We must be pure of thought, word, and deed." And I'd just go, "Yes, sister." And then my head would start imagining what she looked like naked. Oh! That sin's not in the books. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, I ain't going to go into church and tell the guy in the priest in the box about that one, man. Because he's going to come out of that box after me. I know that there's something wrong with me that isn't wrong with the other people. And I felt that if there was a God, there's something, I'm so stained that he ain't going to help me. And as the years passed on and my drinking accelerated, I started doing some things that I was very, very ashamed of. And I started to loathe myself, which is not uncommon, especially to the things I did to my mother and father and sister and some of the women that I sort of loved, I guess, to the capacity of a self-centered person's capable of. I hurt a lot of people. And it's no wonder that I end up loathing myself, because if someone else would have hurt the people I loved like I did, I think I'd want to kill them. So I start loathing myself, and I don't feel very good about me. I don't feel very... And I get sober, and it's at least when I'm drinking, I'm numbing it a little bit. I'm pathetic, but at least I'm numbing it a little bit. And I don't know what's wrong, and you guys keep talking about God did this. God. I was so afraid of God. I remember I was in an institution up in Waterville, Maine, and one of my... You guys told me it was a geographic. I thought I was trying to avoid incarceration. I'm in this treatment center, and they brought in a group of trustees from Thomaston State Penitentiary. And this one guy, I remember, he got my attention. He was the speaker. And I'd never seen anyone in AA that looked like this guy. He had big arms on him, covered with tattoos. Now, this is before tattoos were chic. These are blue ink prison tattoos. And this guy was a rough, he was part of an outlaw motorcycle gang, and he evidently had shot a cop, and he was a tough guy. And he started sharing about stuff. I mean, he got me. I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, I'd drink with this guy. He was cool. Now, the other people in AA, not cool. This guy was cool. And I'm listening to him. And then he talks about, ended up in prison and going to AA. And then he said, "In AA helped me to find God, and it changed my life." When he said he found God, I remember just sinking into my chair thinking, oh, what have they done to him? Oh, not him. He's cool. Not him. Oh, my God. He's a sunbeam for Jesus. Not him. Oh, no. And I felt sorry for him. You know, that's pathetic. I'm dying of alcoholism. I'm probably in my sixth or seventh institution for alcoholism. And I feel sorry for a guy who's lit up and alive and connected because of my prejudices. And that's one of the first things that it says in We Agnostics that I have to do is lay aside my prejudices. And I have the inability to do that because I don't have prejudices. My opinions and judgments are right. You may have prejudices, but my way of... Do you ever have an idea that you're convinced of and think to yourself, you know, that might not be right? I don't. It's right. It's right. I mean, it must be right that the smartest guy in the universe thought it. I mean, it must be right. I'm so... Even though I have no self-esteem, I have this gigantic ego, and I'm so defended, and I don't know it. And this is killing me. And then what happened in 1978, after relapsing for many years, I tried to kill myself. And I was at that place Clancy talks about, no friendly direction. And I, because I'm secretly a coward, I couldn't do it. And I didn't understand. But right after that, I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, there's a line in our book that I read after I was sober a while, and I thought, oh my God, that's exactly what had happened to me. And it talks about before you ever come to believe in God, before a guy like me would even believe in AA, for that matter, it says you'll come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as you'd been living it. And then you get to a place where there is nothing left. No friendly direction, there's nothing left. Except to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools that you guys have been laying at the feet of a smart guy who's smarter than that stuff, right? And so I never did it. I never took the actions. I was unsponsorable. I was unteachable. I was full of myself, and I didn't know it. And that's the dangerous part, is I don't even know it. And in 1978, after this failed suicide attempt, I took some actions that if I wouldn't have been so demoralized, I would have never taken. You guys took advantage of my weakness. And I'm really grateful for that. And I spend a lot of time trying to take advantage of other people's weakness. And you got me to do some things. One of the things I did, I was still in the hospital, the detox, and I asked a man, I was so scared to ask him, you know, because I think he's going to say no. I think he's going to reject me. I want to ask him to sponsor me. And here, I feel like he's going to look at me and say, I don't sponsor losers. Like, I really believe that because I've always unconsciously and emotionally felt like that you must surely think about me the way I do. See, I would have rejected me. And I didn't know that he'd say yes. So I had to up the ante a little bit, and I said, and I'll do anything you ask me to do. And I had no idea that they actually have things they want you to do. I mean, actually quite a few things, and none of them seem like a good idea until after you do them. Then we all say the same thing. Oh, I should have done that years ago. Isn't it funny how much I resist doing the things that will change my life? It's an uncanny, hideous part of me. Because I'll tell you what, I think my ego has survival mechanisms that are probably stronger than me, mine, my own personal. Because there have been times in my life where I would rather die than be wrong, right? The idea of giving up control and giving up my, man, it was tough. So I asked this man, and he... one of the first directions he gave me was he wanted me to get down physically, get down on my knees. And that's embarrassing. I got out of there and went in a halfway house with a whole bunch of men. He wants me to physically get down on my knees in the morning and at night and ask. He said to me, he didn't even say I had to use the word God. He said, just ask whatever's running the universe for help. And I know, they're tricking you. But I did it because I just was so demoralized. I thought, what do I got to lose? I'll just do it. I'll just do whatever they're asking me to do. And I started to do that. And I was in this halfway house, so I couldn't pray in the where all the bunk beds and stuff are with the guys, because I am not praying in front of a bunch of guys. I tell you, they'd have a dress on me within a week. I am not going to do that. I am so afraid of what you think of me. So I had to go in the bathroom and lock the door, take the throw rug, push it up under the crack in the door so nobody can peek under there and see me pray, which is really kind of silly, but that's how paranoid I was of what you might think of me. And I get down on my knees and I'd feel stupid and I don't believe in God. I just say the words. And I remember going back to him and just saying, I don't really believe in God. You know, I feel like a hypocrite doing this. I don't think I should be praying. He said, you've been a hypocrite all your life. What's the difference? Just do it. I did it. And he said another time, right after that, I said to him, well, how come, you know, I go to meetings and I hear people, some people don't, there's a lot of people in AA that don't get on their knees. There's guys that pray sitting on the can. There's guys praying, laying in bed. There's guys praying, walking to work. There's guys praying a lot of different ways. How come I got to get on my knees? And he said, you know, you're right. Not everybody does. He said, but guys with egos like yours do. And I don't have any idea what I didn't know that getting on my knees wasn't for God, it was for me. It was taking a humble position. And I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous is such an action program that it doesn't matter how I feel, it doesn't matter what I think, it only matters what I do. And you guys had me taking selfless actions that were against my natural egotistical inclinations, and it started to change me. And one of my favorite lines in We Agnostics is that God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. And here I am, I'm a guy who doesn't believe in God. I'm a guy who's cursed God. I'm a guy who just feels so decrepit. And you had me take the actions that, unbeknownst to me, opened the door. And from the moment I started to position myself as if God existed, some strange things started occurring in my life. These little coincidences, you know, I mean, they happen. I've heard this experience shared by probably 100 people in AA who came here and didn't believe in God, but were desperate enough to take the actions and position themselves as if the power existed. And what happened is they tapped into the power. And that's exactly what had happened to me. My life started to change. I started to have all these coincidences happened that were all in my favor. It was like I was getting lucky. Now, I've never been a lucky guy. I'm a disaster magnet. I am not a good luck magnet. And all of a sudden, everything I need is starting to be facilitated in my life, often from strangers, often from the universe itself is like it's bending around to kind of accommodate me. I got the perfect job for me when I was new, and I didn't think I could get a job. I had a terrible track record with employment. It was the perfect job. It wasn't the one I wanted. God had that one. But it was the perfect job for me. It allowed me to get deeper into AA. It allowed me to go to a lot of meetings. It allowed me to just enough money. Not to be a big shot, but just enough to get by. And it was perfect. I had a men's that you pushed me into making. I don't want to make. This isn't going to work, and it worked. I remember I was facing 2 years, and I in my mind the possibility of more than that because I didn't. I thought I was afraid that they were going to tack on time for splitting and coming cross country. And you guys pushed me into facing that and talking to my, writing my PO a letter and following it up with a phone call. And I was scared to death. Scared to death. And I remember this phone call. It was, you told me to pray and just for God's will. Well, I don't know. God's will might not, I don't think, that doesn't sound good to me. I said to a guy one time, well, I was new. I said, well, what if God wants me to go to India and work with lepers in the ghetto or something? And he said, you know, God would get doctors and people with educations and stuff to do that. You can't even keep a hold of a job, for God's sakes. I mean, he's not going to use you. He's got all kinds of people before you. You're way down on the list of going to India. And so I started to come to believe. I think that guys like me and a lot of the guys I sponsor, we are God-resistant people. It's almost like I had this God barrier. And the only, you can't think your way through it. You can't get, the only way you can come to believe is to take the actions that eventually, experientially convince you that there's something here and it evidently loves me. I don't know why it loves me. I don't think it should love me. But the evidence is overwhelming that it does. And I came to believe. Now, a lot of guys at that point, and I had this too. You think you've arrived somewhere when you come to believe. If you've arrived anywhere, it's the beginning of the road. There's a big difference between faith and what we talk about in AA of conscious, intermittent conscious contact. You know, if you've read William James, or if you're just in your own experience in AA, there's a lot of alcoholics, many, many, even clergy, who believe in God and drink again. That faith doesn't seem to be enough for me. I have to take it into a personal connection that's vital. And I can't hold it. I don't know anybody that can. The only people that seem to feel connected to God 24/7 are on TV asking for money. It's like I do drive-bys with God. You know, I got to. And I didn't arrive. I arrived at the beginning of the road. The difference between faith and conscious contact, you guys that drove here, you'll go and get in your cars and you'll drive home at the end of this conference and you'll drive home with faith that there are traffic laws and there are police to enforce them. You get a cop in your rearview mirror with his lights on, you've got conscious contact. And one is in your reality and it's experiential and it's right now. And the other is just in your head. It's just in your head. And I'll tell you something. If there have been times in my sobriety where if I hadn't had a sense of the presence of God in my life, even though I don't have it at the moment, but I'd had it, and I knew it was real, it was experiential. There have been times when my back is up against the wall and my fear is on me and I'm scared to death. And if I didn't have that experience of being redeemed, being scared to death before and having God take care of me, and then having those moments where you feel that thing, you know. And usually when I have that, I hit that feeling of connection, it's usually has to do with helping some guy. Like, I've had it in the middle of fifth steps. And I've had it on a 12-step call, many 12-step calls, where you just all of a sudden that shift occurs inside of me, and the person who's suffering is really important to me. And I'm free of me at that moment enough to have an experience with God. See, I think that's the problem. Is that's why guys like me, with a lot of faith, have drank themselves to death, because I have to have an experience with God. And I think the book says that that's the main purpose of what we do here. But I got to take this somewhere, and so you got me doing actions that I don't want to do. Like, I'll tell you, step 12 facilitated step 2 for me in helping, trying to help newcomers. That's what really, I think that's where guys like me come to believe. That's where guys like me, everything that happens that's decent happens as I'm forgetting myself and helping you. I had a guy when I was new, he was talking to me about step 3. And he wanted me to take step 3, and I'm still new. I don't believe in God yet. I'm not as defended as I had been about it, and I'm not as argumentative as I had been about it. But I still, I'm an agnostic of sorts. I'm afraid to take to say even to myself that there is a God, that because I'm afraid the rug will be pulled out from under me, and so I'm hesitant. And this guy said, you have to take step three. And I said to this guy, Joe, I can't. And he said, why not? I said, well, the truth is, Joe, I don't believe in God. I mean, I have no understanding of God. And he said, you don't have to believe in God to take step three. And I said, well, Joe, that's what it said. Look at step two, for God's sakes. And I was in this AA club, and the steps are on the wall. I said, came to believe, Joe, I don't really have that. And then made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. I don't understand Him. I don't even know if He exists, for God's sakes. And he said to me again, you do not have to believe in God to take step three. And then he said, I'll tell you what, kid, I'll make you a promise. And he points to a chair in the Alano Club, and he says, if you turn your will and your life over this chair, I promise you an instantaneous miracle. And I just, being a wise guy, I just said, okay, I turned my will and my life over to the chair. It seems like a stupid thing. And he said to me, he said, the miracle is your life is now no longer in the hands of an idiot. And I got that. I mean, I got that. I mean, I wasn't offended by that. I just said, oh yeah. Oh, because I knew I was seeing the damage in my life that was all wrought on good intentions. And I could see it, you know. I mean, and maybe you're like me. Maybe if your friends or loved ones or family had observed you for the last couple of years of your drinking, and maybe well into your sobriety, because I don't stop making stupid decisions when I get sober. As a matter of fact, I make them with greater clarity. it's actually kind of worse in sobriety. But anyone who would watch me, or possibly you, for God's sakes, how could you come to any conclusion except whoever's making decisions for Bob must be out to kill him? And yet, if you had the mind of a chronic alcoholic, a self-justifying, rationalizing, defending mind like I do, it never looks that way to me inside. I have explanations for everything. But it doesn't change the fact that I'm the guy who's in trouble. That no matter what job I've ever had, I'm the guy that's leaving. No matter what nice things have ever come to me, somehow they got screwed up. If you were to send a CSI team into my life when I'm in trouble, I'm telling you, they'll find my DNA all over everything. And no one else's. And yet I have a tendency to judge myself by my intentions. And you guys started helping me through the rest of the steps to start looking at myself and waking up to something that's I was never awake to. I don't see me. I see the story about me in my head. And so consequently, if you're self-centered, that means you live up here in the control center and story of you. If you're like me and you do that, you don't understand why they fired you. You don't understand why she left you. You don't understand why those people are not talking to me anymore. Because you can't see it. But if you could see what they saw, you go, oh, God, if I was the boss, I'd have fired me a long time before he did. My God, if I was in a relationship with someone who was acting like Bob was, I'd have left that long time ago. And I was asleep in the daydream of my own life. I didn't get it. I was really asleep here. I didn't understand any of it. And I suspect at times today I'm still asleep in my life. It recovery is a funny thing. It's never ending, and it's progressive. If you stay in the trenches and you keep doing the deal, it seems like you get more awake and more awake and more awake. I'm 30, a little over 36 years sober. I look at myself when I was 20 years sober, and I was a bit of a knucklehead. I mean, I was, you know, I, I had some things I thought were so about me, I found out later, nah, that wasn't really the way it was. I was listening to my own story about it. And I was wrong. And then when I was 20 years, I could look at stuff at 10 years and see it where I was so convinced that things were that way and they were that way and they were doing this to me. And it wasn't true. Which leads me to believe if there's a consistency in that, the chances are at 45 years sober, if I live that long, I'm going to look at Bob in 36 years and think, wow, you were an idiot. You were an idiot. I think one of the greatest things that's ever happened to me is that I became suspect of my own perception and suspect of what I think and believe. I think from that comes all the potential for growth. Because egocentric people do not entertain that. Even though if I'm locked up in me and you ask me, is it possible you can be wrong, Bob? I will say, well, of course very possibly I could be wrong. Now, I don't mean that. I just want, the egocentric people want the bragging rights of the humble without actually being humble. You know, I want you to think I'm humble, so I will say things like, oh, I could be wrong. You ever hear an alcoholic say that? He knows he's right. It's like standing before the judge saying, guilty, Your Honor, but with an explanation. And so you guys had me, you encouraged me to say this prayer on page 63. And you didn't just tell me to go say the prayer. You had my first sponsor had me read page 60 through 63 over and over and over again. And you know, if you've read that, it talks about the actor who wants to run the whole show and he's forever trying to arrange the lights, the scene, you know, all that stuff. And I'm not that guy. Not at all. Now, there's some people in AA that are really like that. I can see that very clearly. I submit, you really want to see that clearly? Go to a business meeting. Oh, my God. There's some control freaks in AA, I'm telling you. Isn't it odd that if you have the mind I got, I can see so clearly that you're trying to run the show, and I could be taking very similar actions in a different place, and I'm not trying to run the show. I'm trying to make things nice here. See, because my way is the right way. You're stupid. You're a control freak. But this is... And I don't just try to run the universe. I have a tendency... Mentally, I like to make it global. You know what I'm saying? Like, if I want to straighten someone out in AA, it's not because I'm personally offended by their behavior. I have to make it into a case where this is for the good of all of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? I have to get this magnanimous thing, you know, where it's... You know, they'll build a statue of me at GSO by straightening this guy. You know, the more I run that stuff through my head, the more I imagine that I'm leading some herd of righteousness into the future. I had a bad day. Bad day. I went to work, and it was just one of those days, and nothing big. Some of my worst days in sobriety have not been because of big things that occur. My ego rises to those occasions. It's the little mouse turds in the road that trip me up. You know what I mean? It's not the mountains. It's the little stuff. It's the little annoyances. It's like death by a thousand paper cuts. You know what I mean? It's just the little stuff. Oh, God. And I was having one of those days where everybody's irritating me. Nobody's doing it right. I'm at work and I'm busting my butt trying to get this stock put up, and the other two people are just drinking coffee, laughing and telling jokes up at the register, not even helping. Boss comes in, having coffee with them, doesn't even come, he's not even noticing the amazing job I'm doing here, and all by myself the amazing job I'm doing. He doesn't even notice that. And I'm getting up and tight. I get off work and I'm running to the grocery store. I got to get some styrofoam cups. I'm the secretary of this meeting, and I get in that 12 items or less line, and behind a woman with 15 items, I've counted them twice. It's just so embarrassing. The second time I was like this. It's kind of pathetic, really. Nobody pays attention to me as much as I do. What I wanted to do, I wanted to go get the manager and bring him up here and make him count the 15 items underneath the 12. But I'm in a hurry because I got a new guy meeting me at the meeting. So I'm kind of on a mission from God, and I'm in a hurry to get there because I don't want this new guy getting there before me. And so I get those cups. I get in my car. Now I'm driving like a crazy person, afraid I'm going to be late. And I'm on Maryland Parkway, which is three lanes this way and three lanes this way, and I'm in the fast lane behind a slow driver going below the speed limit. Some old woman, I remember just, I had this insane thought that I didn't think was insane. I look back and it was insane. That I am going to floor it. I'm going to push us both on in the oncoming traffic. We'll probably be killed, but she'd see. You know, I mean, oh, that's crazy thinking. That is like crazy thinking. I didn't do it because that'd just make me later. I get to the meeting, and the new guy, you know, the new guy's there. You know where he's sitting? In the back of the room. Get up here, sit right there. And I laid it out. I got the literature in place. I tell you, I can lay out some literature. I waited for the perfect guy. I got this guy, Mark Perkins, and I got another guy. I got the two guys that I know to chair and co-chair this meeting that are going to do a great job. And I asked the one guy, I said, you know, instead of reading chapter 5, we got a new guy here, let's read chapter 3. And he said, yeah, sure. They start the meeting, they read chapter 3. I'm just watching my newcomer to see if, you know, if he's getting any of this. And so I know, I'm just imagining him getting a year mention of my name, you know. The chairman says, does anybody have anything they want to kick us off with? And some guy, new guy, I don't even know who he is, raises his hand and starts talking about shooting heroin. Well, some other guy jumps him and says, hey, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't talk about that. Well, some other guy jumps in and says, hey, this is AA, he can talk about whatever he wants to talk about. And this is the meeting from hell. I mean, I'm sitting there and the whole vision of him, new guy getting his year, mentioning my name is like smoke in the wind as it just sort of evaporates. And I am pissed, man. I think I'm the only one here that cares about anything. I was ready to quit. Quit AA. I'm just tired of this. Stupid people. And I go home, and like Pavlov's dog, I called my sponsor, and he says, read page 60 through 63. And I get to the bottom of page 60. And it says that we're like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the scenery, the ballet, the people in the grocery store, the other people you work with, the people sharing in the meeting, the people driving in traffic in your own way. If only your arrangements would stay put, life would be great. Things would be wonderful. And it, for the first time in my life, I saw that that was me. And not that it was just had become me. I had been that guy all my life, and I didn't know it. Chamberlain used to say, you can only see what you can see when you can see it. And it's sad and odd and to know that I could be the guy trying to direct the universe and not know it. And no wonder I was depressed a lot of the time. No wonder. You know what depression is? That's when God stops doing your will. You know, and I was in the anxiety and the worry all the time because it's the anxiety of playing God. You know, I am trying to arrange the universe, and it's hard to be in the cosmos a big shot when you're really a little shot. I don't have the power to do that. I never did. But I fancy I do. That's why I love resentments. Resentments would give me such a sense of power. I could be up in my head having conversations with people that aren't in the room, you know. But I just, here's the kind of conversation I have. I hit them with that, and then they say that. And I know they're going to say that, so I hit them with this. And then they say that, and then here it comes. Wham! I hit them with a truth that is unbearable to them. And they realize how wrong they'd been. And you have those fantasies, you just kind of, and then I just go to work and silently hate the person again like I did the day before. You know, because I don't have any power. I never did. So I get down on my knees with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I say the third step prayer, the one on page 63, where I'm offering myself to God for Him to do with me and build with me as He wills. Well, I can't do that. I know what they're saying. They're saying that I got to try to make my life none of my business. For God's sakes, how can you stop thinking about yourself when that's all you've ever thought about? How can you stop worrying about yourself when that's all you've ever worried about? How can you stop being concerned with yourself if that's the only thing you've ever been concerned with? I can't. And it says in there that we can't wish this self-centeredness away any more than we could alcohol. We have to have God's help. And so I say in the next line in the prayer, I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self. See, I'm hostage to my own obsessive self-involvement. I am captive in my own self-interest. No wonder I don't feel like I fit out here. And I never did. Because self-centered people don't live out here. We live up here. Disconnected and disassociated from life itself. That's why most of my life I'd get sober and everybody seemed so far away from me. As if there was some invisible yet impenetrable barrier between me and life itself. A barrier that at one time alcohol brought down and let me get free. And at the end of my drinking, there's no freedom anywhere, really. And so I ask God to relieve me of the bondage of self. And if He'll do that, if He'll take away these difficulties, Chuck used to say there's only one problem and it contains all problems. And it's the separation. But the separation is because there's too much of me between me and God and me and you. So if He'll relieve me of this bondage of self, and He'll take away my difficulties with it. I mean, I didn't understand that they were talking about the difficulties were the difficulties with the bondage of self. I say the prayer, take away my difficulties, and I have a list, God. I mean, here, you know what I mean? It's not about that. It's not about me. It's the difficulties with the bondage of self for one reason and one reason only, so that victory over this would bear witness to those I would help. I've got to help people. You know what I mean? The third step? Help some people. You know what I mean? The third step? Forget yourself. It's hard. You can't do it up here. You can only do it in your actions. In the altruistic actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all we got. That's all I got here. I've never been able to will myself or educate myself free from myself. I can't do it. I've tried. I've always thought that if I had enough knowledge, but I can take actions that are altruistic in nature. I can do 12-step work. I can do things that I don't want to do. I can act in a selfless manner. I can take inconvenient actions. I can do the actions of self-sacrifice. I can do those things. I can put you before me. Which is, I can do it in my actions. I may not be able to do it mentally and emotionally, but I can do it in my actions. And a funny thing happens. If you do that, it starts to change you in here. Not quickly. I'm just as self-centered, I believe, today and selfish by nature as I probably have ever been. And yet, if you were to objectively observe me from a distance, what you would see is a guy who doesn't look so much like that anymore. Even though in here, I'm still the number one thing I worry about. But out here, I conduct myself in a manner that has been freeing for me, freeing from the bondage of self. I'll tell you, I think that all steps from everything we do with sponsorship, with service, with him trying to put the traditions in my life, all of it is to facilitate a decision that in and of myself I can't carry out the decision in step three. I can't. And I know because I went through a long period of time before I actually did an inventory out of the book, and I would get down on my knees in the morning, and I made this a habit for years. I still do it, not every morning anymore. I've changed up. I've walked away from a lot of them. I still say some of those prayers, but my prayers with God now are more conversational. Because I wanted, years ago, I decided I wanted a more intimate relationship with God. It's pretty hard to have an intimate relationship with someone if you just run through the room and throw a paragraph at them that's rehearsed and then leave. I mean, it's not. So I wanted to have a little more intimacy with God, so I wanted to actually talk to Him. I mean, honestly and genuinely. And about the things I'm afraid of and the things I so. And to acknowledge how much I need His help every day. And to acknowledge that I don't know what's best for me. I think I do, but I really don't. I'll take what you think is best for me. I'll take what you think is best for me. Because the track record now with God is that God's vision of Bob's life has been extremely better than my vision of my life. And so I do that, and I think everything else we do here is to facilitate this decision. Because I would get down on my knees for the first couple years, and I'd say that third step prayer. I wouldn't even be off my knees 10 minutes, and I'd be up in the control center running the universe again. I couldn't stop it with the intention, and it wasn't that I didn't have the intention of carrying out the decision. I just didn't have the ability. One of my favorite, there's a comedian, Ron White, and he has this great line, and I think this, I just love it. He talks about his DUI, and he says he got arrested, and the police gave him the right to remain silent, and then he said, they just didn't give me the ability. See, I have lived a lot of my life with knowing how I should be, and an absolute inability to be that guy, because lack of power is my dilemma. But you know, it's funny, you take these actions, and in my experience, I've taken these actions, and I've taken these actions, and I've taken these actions, and you stick your head up one day, and you realize, things are different. I mean, I'm still a hideously selfish and self-centered person by nature, but things are different. And I didn't really do that. I just availed myself of the power by taking the actions. And I think that a lot of times this is God's grace is like the wind. The wind, if you're out in the ocean in a sailboat and you don't know what you're doing, the wind can turn you over. It can push you back. But if you know how to set the sail, you can catch the power. And I didn't know how to catch the power or set the sail. And you guys, you just said, do this. Well, I don't want to do that. Well, just do that. And you do it, and things just little shifts, little tiny little shifts. And I didn't know that you were giving me actions that would eventually facilitate the accessing of a power in my life. And if standing here right now, this moment, I am very, very grateful for what you've done in my life. But I also know that within 20 minutes I'll forget that, right? I can't seem to hold it. Any kind of awakening, any kind of good stuff in my life, I can't seem to hold it. And I guess that is in the chronic nature of this disease. I regress as much as I progress. I came here with a default position, and the default position was me. And you guys have been trying for years to get me to take actions that changes the default position. Throughout that whole book, it says we did this, we did that, we did this, and then we turned our attention to someone we could help. You were trying to instill in me through my actions a new default position. And it kind of has taken somewhat. And in that has come a freedom. There's only one freedom that's worth anything, and that's freedom from the bondage of self. I don't have that 24/7, but I have it intermittently, and it's sweet. Thank you for my life.
Thank you, Bob, for that wonderful share. I tell him that's